Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. Warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Thanks for being with me today. As always, I love our time together, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you. If you have any interests or guests that you'd like me to talk to, I'd always love to get good suggestions from listeners, because you always give me great suggestions. If you've read a spectacular book or you've read a fascinating article, pass it along to me, bill@myfaithradio.com. I'd love to see what you're reading and hear about what you're studying, and maybe we can find a way to get it on the air. That'd be awfully nice if you want to take the time to send me a note, bill@myfaithradio.com. I want to start with 3 John. It's only one chapter. I love this verse starting in 5. Dear friends, oh, wait, let me back up. Verse 2. Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. So that's my prayer and my wish for you today. I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. And if you're struggling with your health, I will be praying for you as I go to break in this next 30 seconds. When we return, Rob Bluey from the Daily Signal will be joining me. Be back in 60.
Maybe you wish it were easier to make time to be with God, but your schedule is overwhelming already. Or when you do open the Bible, it leaves you with more questions than answers. The one-year Devotions for Women with Jill Briscoe gives deeper understanding of the Scripture and makes it easier to spend time reading God's Word each day. We're giving away one copy every week this month. Enter to win at myfaithradio.com.
Philippians 4:8 says, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. But it can be difficult to focus on these things when you're going about your day. Start each day with the verse of the day to focus your mind on the right things. Each day we'll send you a short Bible verse to encourage and uplift you. Sign up for the verse of the day online at myfaithradio.com under the subscriptions tab.
I always look forward to talking to my friend Rob Bluey from Washington, D.C. He's always got the most update news from what's going on in the nation's capital. He is the editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com to get your news, because it's all there. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill. It's good to be back with you today.
Thank you so much. And now we've got baseball season starting on the professional level, but also at your son's level. You're coaching this year.
Yes, yeah. My two boys are both playing, and I'm coaching the little guys' team. So, you know, it's fun. It's I look forward to doing it because it's a way to not only give back to the community, but hopefully make a good impression and be a mentor for some young ball players. So look forward to it. And, you know, at this age, they're not so much in it to win it, but to have fun.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you doing that. A couple of dads pitch in, or is it just you, or – how many are helping?
Oh yeah, it's a whole number of dads. In fact, it's really made possible because of all of the parental involvement. And even if you're not an official coach, we find ways to put people to work and help out of practice and games.
Nice. Well, the city is abuzz, I'm sure, with the Mueller report finally coming available, and now it's just nuts.
You have that right. It is a buzz. I mean, there is all sorts of things happening. There's probably so much happening, Bill. We don't have enough time to talk about it all, but where should we begin?
Well, let's begin with the fact that there is apparently, no collusion. And, you know, President Trump is saying full exoneration, and there's pushback against that.
That's correct. So, of course, the both sides will do their attempt to spin this. I mean, I think that it's an acknowledgement, even if you are on the left or if you're in the media, that there is no collusion, and there's not a lot of ways you can spin that. I think that you see some Democrats coming out and saying, well, we need to see the full report. Well, I hope we do see the full report, and I don't think that'll be the end of it, though. There'll always be accusations flying, and you can bet that House Democrats and the committees they control will be looking into various other things related to President Trump. So even though this report has been concluded, this is probably not the end of the road. But you're right on the point about obstruction, because Robert Mueller did make a statement that it was inconclusive in some respect, and although the president says he was fully exonerated and DOJ is not going to pursue any action, you know, there is perhaps an opportunity and an opening that some on the left will try to seize. But I think, Bill, and perhaps your listeners can tell me otherwise, but it's one of those things where I think most Americans should be grateful by the outcome of this. We never want to have a candidate running for office who is colluding with a foreign power, especially Russia. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the process that we went through hopefully restores some of the trust and resolve that we have in government and the institutions that that looked into this matter. There's nobody who could do a more thorough job than what Robert Mueller did, and we're grateful for that.
Yeah. Should we point out that all of this Russia stuff happened under Obama's watch?
Well, you know, that's certainly something that the president's pointing out and saying that there needs to be investigations and an analysis done of those who took certain actions during the Obama administration. Why? You know, I think my colleague John Malcolm said it best. He has been somebody who has worked at the Department of Justice and understands these issues in much greater detail than I do. And he said, when you have a situation where you know, somebody is informed of what's going on, you would think that the way to maybe counter a suspicion of collusion would be to actually talk to the principal involved ahead of time and try to take some action here. So I think the whole process about how this played out during the 2016 campaign was suspicious. I think there are those who want retribution. I'm more of a forward-looking guy, Bill, as you know, so I'm hoping that we can move on to some of the other challenges that our country is facing. I do want those to be held accountable who deserve to be held accountable, but I hope we don't have to spend the next 2 years talking about Russia as much as we have the past 2 years.
Yeah, I can't find the statistic, but there was something in the 235 or 500,000 articles that were written on Trump and collusion. So the media never stopped. They never took their foot off the gas when it came to keeping this story alive.
That's you're absolutely correct on that point. There were the broadcast hours, the news stories that were written, the all of the tweets that were made about this. I mean, you can go down the list. There was certainly a lot of ink spilled to cover this story. And I think it's important for the news media to take a step back. You're seeing some of those reflections take place. You're seeing people like Jeff Zucker at CNN saying, we're not investigators. You're seeing others defending the large amount of press coverage that that was devoted to this. Of course, you know, journalists don't have access to the same levers that somebody like Robert Mueller has. At the same time, there is a responsibility that I think journalists need to take. And when you invite guests on your news program and you let them say things that are blatantly false and untrue and you don't go about correcting them, I do hold them responsible for that. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen an erosion in trust in institutions like the news media.
Mm-hmm. Rob, when CNN's president, Jeff Zucker, says that he has no regrets that CNN spent so much time on the Russia hoax coverage, he said, we're not investigators. Really? Okay, so that's you're spending a lot of time perpetuating something you don't know absolutely to be true.
And, you know, I CNN, I bet some of the investigative journalists at CNN might take issue with that comment.
I would think so.
I'm not sure how you can call yourself an investigative journalist if your boss is saying you're not doing investigations. I mean, that's one of the things that we're proud of at the Daily Signal is we'd like a bigger budget and more staff to do investigative journalism, because I think that's the one thing that we probably need more of. We need less of the punditry and more of the reporting. So, you know, whether it's CNN or MSNBC or any of the newspapers that that devoted so much coverage to this, I think the one thing is clear. It was a compelling story, and in many cases we saw ratings go up, we saw subscriptions increase, and it was driven largely because of the coverage of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't fault them for trying to chase down a story. What I guess I do fault them for is leading their audience to believe that that there was really something that was nefarious taking place, when I think other outlets, and the Daily Signal included here, you know, took a step back and said, you know what, before we actually put an entire team of reporters on this this beat, let's evaluate it. We will cover it when major news happens. And Bill, I think that's how you and I handled it throughout the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. Is when it was pertinent to talk about, we did, but we didn't obsess over it every week. And some of these networks and papers literally had people devoted to this day in and day out, and that was probably a bit of a overreach and a mistake on their part.
Yeah, there were Russian collusion junkies out there. They couldn't get enough of it.
You're absolutely right on that.
Yeah, yeah.
You saw it so many times, and you did. And we should point out here that we're not painting a monolithic picture. There were people on the left who warned some of the other people that they, you know, share their political views, that they should not attach everything that they have to this. You saw that in the case of a lot of people who were demanding impeachment before you actually had any evidence that the president committed a crime. And I don't know where that whole movement goes now. But I hope that we can move on, and I think that's one of the reasons why people are somewhat celebrating Nancy Pelosi and saying, was she clairvoyant? What did she know, and why was she saying that we need to move on from impeachment a couple of weeks ago before we even got to the point where we are today?
Yeah. Rob, I'd like to ask you a couple more questions about the Mueller report, and then maybe we can put it to rest forever. Rob Louie is my guest, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. We'll take a little break and be right back. Show. I've got Rob Louie on the line. He is the editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. We're chatting a little bit right now about the Mueller report and some of the after effects of that. And what, Rob, are the ways that the Democrats are responding to the Mueller report? The Daily Signal has got a great analysis on the four ways the Democrats are responding. Can you share some of that?
Well, thank you, Bill. And I hope your listeners will check out our story and our other coverage on this. So I think first and foremost, you know, there are a number of things that the Democrats will attempt to do. I agree with some of them, which is that we should see the full Mueller report. To the extent that the attorney general can release it and there's not classified material in there, I would like to see it as much as everybody else. So certainly I agree with some of the calls to do that. You're going to see attempts to make the attorney general, Bill Barr, testify before Congress. I think that's pretty standard practice and something that will likely happen. I mean, he'll be mm-hmm. testifying before Congress on another issue, and this will come up, I'm sure,
sure.
If it's not specifically on this. There will be, further examinations by the various committees. The committee chairmen do hold a significant amount of power in terms of what they can do and witnesses they can call. That will happen on both sides, by the way. Lindsey Graham, the Senate Judiciary chairman, who is a Republican, and wants to call James Comey, for instance. So I think you'll see it both ways. And then the final and fourth way, which we've mentioned already, is impeachment. There are some Democrats who say, regardless of whether the president committed a crime or not, we still want to pursue impeachment. impeachment. We just think he's unfit for office, and you're going to see them want to take Democrats down that road. I think that the leadership will resist that because they want to keep the focus on other issues other than impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Rob, the Wall Street Journal had a article on the whole Russia story being a catastrophic media failure. What are your thoughts on that?
I think in many cases it was. You had a situation that, you know, what came first? Was the media so obsessed with Russia that it prompted government officials to demand this level of investigation, or was it the other way around? Was it concern amongst the population and the individuals who didn't like the results of the election, who, you know, did things in ways that they got us down this path, you know, 2 years ago? Look, the fact of the matter is that we've had a situation now, a story dominating so many newspapers and the coverage on newscasts that we could have been focused on actually solving some big problems facing our country. And I think that is the biggest regret that a lot of these media outlets need to face, is that at a time when we didn't necessarily need to sow this division among President Trump and so many Americans, there could have been a focus on other issues. Issues that I think actually the broad base of American people support. I mean, who doesn't want a thriving economy? Who doesn't want to help people get back to work? You know, those are kitchen table issues that I think this president is focused on, which have been completely overshadowed by an obsession on Russia.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you, Rob, which I always usually do. So is anyone going to apologize, or are we way past that? We don't do that.
I don't think anybody apologizes for anything anymore.
Okay.
I mean, we're living in this world, particularly when it comes to politics and the media, where an apology, and this is true of the president himself, he sees people who apologize as weak. So I would not expect very many people to apologize. There will, of course, will be some people here and there, but you know, you've seen it yesterday. You had Kellyanne Conway asking for Adam Schiff, the Intelligence Committee chairman, to step down. You saw that Kevin McCarthy did the same. I think it's unlikely that anyone is going to lose his or her job. The only person who lost his job is Jeff Sessions, who was the one who recused himself from the beginning, and the president summarily dismissed after the November election. So, you know, there have been consequences, but we're not likely to see apologies. And I think that's as somebody who still believes that when you do something wrong, you should apologize, and it's something that I teach my own children. I would like to see that happen, Bill, but I'm just not too confident it actually will.
Mm-hmm. There were some innocent people that got used, taken advantage of. I think George Papadopoulos was back in the news about he was kind of set up, wasn't he?
Well, Jerome Corsi.
Jerome Corsi,
somebody who, an author, somebody who was offered a plea deal, decided not to take it, went public and went to the media. I mean, I saw his comments after the attorney general released the summary and saying that, you know, he was grateful that he did not go down a path where he was entangled in this. So, yeah, no, certainly people's reputations have been damaged. There are people, Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, and others who are suffering some of the consequences based on the decisions they made. I mean, if you lied to the prosecutors, I think you should be held responsible for that. And if you engaged in illegal activity, you should certainly be held responsible. And certainly Robert Mueller did. But one of the things that he made clear is that at the end of the day, there was no collusion here. And I think that's why you see the president celebrating the way he did, because he feels that he was vindicated in mm-hmm. this regard. And I think in many cases, he has a right to make that claim.
Yeah. Rob, another story, of course, that just hit the press is Jussie Smollett is not going to be prosecuted on any of his fake hate crime. They're dropping all the felony charges. So what do you say about that?
Yeah, right. And it's still, I'm glad you brought it up, still a breaking story today. The mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, and the police superintendent were recently came out strongly criticizing the prosecutors and the judge for this move. I'm still trying to make sense of the whole situation. I mean, I've been confused from the get-go, from the earliest charges that Jussie Smollett made to how this all unraveled, and now here we are today, seeing the latest development. Bill, when is this story going to come to an end? I mean, this is just so confusing, and now you wonder will his job at on Empire be restored? Of course, he was kind of cut from the script, so who knows? He himself is complaining that claiming that he's now been vindicated by this action, but I think we need a little bit more information and to see what was actually involved in this agreement before we draw a final conclusion. But it just goes to show that you really do need to be suspicious and not take everything you read and see for granted. There were some people who immediately made assumptions in this case from the start that I think probably regret doing so. So I will avoid doing the same.
Yeah. Rob, we just have a couple of minutes left at thedailysignal.com. Great story on how church plants are helping broken communities. Can you tell us about that in about a minute?
Yeah, I certainly can. My former colleague, Erica Anderson, who is just a terrific person and living in Indianapolis area, has written this story for the Daily Signal. And Bill, I'll tell you, the thing that fascinates me as somebody who goes to a rather traditional Christian, denomination, I in hearing Erica describe this and the thriving nature of these church plants, it is really incredible. And I think it's so gratifying that people are turning to faith and to God and the teachings of Jesus Christ to understand and guide their lives. I mean, it really is reassuring at a time when it seems we just hear negative news, that there is some really good news. So I'd encourage your listeners to check it out and share a comment about what maybe they've experienced in their community. And I hope to see more of this.
Yeah. Rob Blue, you're the gift that gives every week. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and good luck baseball season with your son.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah.
I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. Rob Blue, he's been my guest, editor-in-chief of The Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com to learn more about Rob and all the great colleagues that write such great stuff at The Daily Signal. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Faith Radio is a media outreach ministry of University of Northwestern St. Paul, and we exist to lead people to Christ and to nurture believers in their faith. Together, we are growing in our faith through shows and programs on Faith Radio. You can find out more about these shows and read relevant articles on topics like relationships, business and finance, biblical studies, and church and culture on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back. I always appreciate Rob Bluey. What a friend of the show. And if you have not gone to dailysignal.com, you should go check it out because they write with great integrity. All right. We've got a great second half hour coming up. Pastor Sam Storms is going to join us. And we're going to talk about what to do when Christians clash. Is that possible? Do we not get along? The nice thing is the Bible is brutally honest. So we can find out what we are going to learn from Scripture in terms of what we need to do when we have conflict. And I'm not talking about just little minor spats or disagreements, but significant divisions and conflict. And so you're going to want to stick around. He has got one of the greatest introductions. I'll give you some of it. He is an amillennial, a Calvinistic, charismatic, credo-baptistic, complementarian, Christian hedonist who loves his wife of 45 years, his two daughters, his four grandkids. Books, baseball, movies, and all things. So there you go. That's my next guest coming up. I know you're not going to budge now. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with Pastor Sam Storms in just a minute.
Challenge you.
It is 31 minutes after the hour. Okay, what to do when Christians clash? I don't even think that happens. But in the event it does, we got an expert that can talk about that, Pastor Sam Storms. He's on the board of directors at Desiring God, also serves on the a member of the Council of the Gospel Coalition. So two organizations we like a lot around here. And he's the past president of the Evangelical Theological Society. And he's still serving on the executive committee. Sam, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be with you.
I know. I've always enjoyed when you come on the show because you, you're very interesting and passionate and engaged. And so thank you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I hope so. This will be beneficial to people.
Well, I mean, none of that sounds made up. So I said it with great conviction. So there you go.
Well, thanks.
So, okay, let's talk about Christians clashing. When does that ever happen?
Sure. Well, how about all the time?
All right.
You know, you think even back into the biblical text when the multitude of instances in which Paul urged Christians to be of one mind and to defer to one another. And, you know, I think even Philippians 4, where, you know, had a really godly, joy-filled church, and Paul had to gently rebuke two women who were in conflict. I think their names were Euodia and Syntyche, and you know, called upon them to get things straightened out. They were both co-workers with Paul, and yet something had divided them. And then, of course, the issue I think that has stirred you to ask me to be on today is perhaps the most significant and I think instructive clash was the one that happened between Paul and Barnabas. And the amazing thing is, these just weren't average Joes. These were two apostles. So
yeah.
These are two individuals who had been eyewitnesses of the risen Christ. They had been commissioned. They had been empowered. These guys operated in the miraculous together. They traveled together. And yet I think the ESV translates it, a significant conflict or significant split that happened between them.
This is a little more than just a falling out, isn't it?
I think it is. You know, it's interesting, the language. In fact, let me be more accurate. It says they had a sharp disagreement.
Okay.
So again, this wasn't, that's in Acts chapter 15, verse 39. So we're not talking about, you hold to that millennial view and I hold to this one, or, you know, this was something that was apparently so intense that it led them to split up, and they went their separate ways. Now, eventually, of course, they reunited, but it was pretty severe.
Mm-hmm. And we've been doing it ever since, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. And, the amazing thing about this particular story is that people always want to ask the question, who was in the right, who was in the wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And I am of the conviction that both of them were. If people don't know about the reason for the split, it's described back earlier in Acts chapter 13, where it talks about Mark, who was Barnabas's cousin, had joined them on Paul's second missionary journey. And it just simply says that Mark chose not to go with them. He says he left them and returned to Jerusalem. We aren't told why. There are, dozens of speculations about why he left them. Paul interpreted that as a sign of weakness and immaturity, and he couldn't be trusted. Barnabas said, well, yeah, you're probably right, but we need to give people a second chance, and he's a good man, and I think we need to encourage him. And they couldn't agree, so they ended up going their separate ways. And, you know, the amazing thing about this is that the way God's providence makes use of even our sin and our disagreements, it ended up leading to two missionary groups going out instead of one. You know, Barnabas took Mark and went one direction. Paul took Silas and went another. But it was a pretty serious split, which makes the reconciliation all the more remarkable.
Mm-hmm. So when we are encountering clashes, and it happens often, and it's not over minor matters, it's over significant divisions that divide churches and people and followers of Christ, what would be your recommendation for when we're in that position, what to do?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is you have to really carefully analyze the cause for the disagreement, the reason for the split, because oftentimes it's miscommunication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're using different definitions for the same words. Maybe we misunderstood somebody's motives. Probably, you know, in our day, it didn't happen back in the first century, obviously, but in our day, we communicate so much by email and text, and yet that's a very dangerous thing to do when there's a disagreement because you can't read somebody's tone or their facial expression or get a sense for their emotional mindset. And so I think first thing you have to do is sit down and with a, you know, maybe an objective, disinterested third party, say, all right, guys, gals, let's break this down. Is this an issue that is worthy of dividing over? In other words, is somebody denying the resurrection of Jesus, or is somebody affirming the legitimacy of premarital sex? And we need to, these are massively important theological and ethical issues. In most cases, in the evangelical world, it's not that at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's usually we have a different vision for how we ought to go about life as a church, or a difference of opinion on how money needs to be utilized, or what church plant or missionary agency should we support or not support. And I think the first thing we have to do is we have to identify, is this a major foundational issue that we're disagreeing on? And if it is, then it might be worthy of a split. I mean, if I had a pastor on my staff who was denying the bodily resurrection, I would have a serious problem. And I think if there were not a genuine, sincere transformation in his thinking, we would have to split. We would have to part company with him.
Mm-hmm.
But
what about if he had a different end times position than you?
Well, we have that on our staff.
Okay.
The only thing that we affirm in our statement of faith is that Jesus is coming back.
Okay.
We believe the second coming is itself the most foundational issue, and we have a variety of different opinions on eschatology, and we don't fight over it, and we give equal representation to them, and that isn't a problem with us at all. So, again, it's that question of, are these foundational issues that actually, if we take one view over another, are we putting somebody's soul in jeopardy of eternal damnation?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a pretty serious matter, as over against, well, this is my opinion, this is how I was raised, this is what I think works best. And then I think you can work through those, and come out with some agreement or consensus on how you should move forward.
Mm-hmm. Sam, were Paul and Barnabas, when they're having their sharp disagreement, what were they communicating to their followers and the people that were observing this? What message were they sending, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, we don't have any real explicit biblical evidence to tell us what. Evidently, Silas must have agreed with Paul because he traveled with Paul, and Barnabas and Mark went their own way. You know, the interesting factor here is that we have to consider is, what was Peter's role in this? Because Peter was Mark's spiritual father. And we know that Peter had a massive failure, obviously denying Christ three times,
mm-hmm.
and yet he was restored. And I have to believe that there were at least three individuals who were involved in his restoration. Now, what positions other people took, I'm not real sure. But I think Peter must have spoken into it, said, hey, look, buddy, if anybody knows about failure, it's me. Let me tell you, you got to humble yourself. You got to learn from your mistakes, and don't think that you're forever excluded from the kingdom or ministry. And then there was Paul, who probably said, that's true, but we also need to take into consideration the safety of those who are traveling with us, and the welfare and the success of this missionary outreach. And can somebody who bailed out on us like Mark did be trusted? And then Barnabas comes along, and being the great encourager, says, hey, I've watched this young man, and he's repentant, he's broken, he knows the mistake he made, and let's give him another shot. And the good news is, Paul eventually agreed with that, because Mark was restored.
Mm-hmm. Sam, have you had a sharp disagreement with someone, and they've just moved on from your friendship?
There have been a couple of occasions where that has happened, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And just because we're Christians doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
No, I know. I appreciate your vulnerability on that.
Just because we're Christians doesn't mean that it's not going to hurt. It does. And we hope and pray those sorts of things don't happen. But sadly, they do. I mean, I had a staff member several years ago, and he and I had just wildly different perspectives on the nature of the local church. And what church life should look like, and what should be our focus, and where we should put our energy. And it would be one thing if I had just a person in the church, an average member who had that view. But when you're on a staff with somebody, you have to be rowing in the same direction, if you catch my meaning there. You have to have a common vision, a common strategy that you're going to devote yourselves to. And It was a, we knew that it wasn't going to work long term, and as time passed and the opportunity arose for him to leave, he did, and we left on good terms, and we're good friends today.
Well, that's fantastic.
But we just—it's just the simple fact is we weren't going to be able to serve together in the same local church in pastoral leadership.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of people that have relationships that are damaged, and they would love nothing more than that happy ending that you have with this friend. There's restoration there. There's, you know, you guys have made peace, and you're still friends today. And I think there's a lot of people suffering from people have left their friendship, or they have, you know, had a sharp disagreement, and they've wandered away from the friendship, and that's very hurtful.
Yes, it is, and it is, and that's why this story about Paul and Barnabas is so encouraging, because you know, you read in Acts how this disagreement happened, and then they split and went their separate ways, but then you read in Colossians 4. Where Paul is writing to the church at Colossae, and he's talking about the individuals who are with him in his Roman imprisonment,
mm-hmm.
and one of them is Mark. And he has this, Paul says this remarkable thing. He says, Aristarchus greets you, and Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, and then there's this parenthetical statement, concerning whom you have received instructions, if he comes to you, welcome him. So evidently, Paul knew that there were people in the church at Colossae who obviously had heard about this split, and they had their doubts about Mark. And so Paul evidently, through some means, had sent them instructions saying, look, this young man has turned around, he's repented, he's acknowledged his error, and I have affirmed him, and I want you to receive him back into the arms of the church, into the ministry. And then the most remarkable text is in 2 Timothy 4. You know, here's Paul's first Roman imprisonment wasn't that severe. It mm-hmm. wasn't life-threatening. But the one that he's experiencing when he wrote 2 Timothy, this was in probably within days or weeks of his execution. So he knew he was going to die. And Paul writes in 2 Timothy 4 that only Luke is with him, that everybody else has left, either for good reasons, some even abandoned him. But then he makes this remarkable statement. He says, get Mark and bring him with you, for he is very useful to me for ministry. Now, you think about that. And the reason I emphasize this is because some of our listeners are saying to themselves, I don't have much hope that this person who bailed out on me or bailed out on our church is ever going to be restored to any kind of meaningful ministry. And here's Paul, who's in prison facing death, and the one person that he wants there with him. Think of that. The one individual is the one who had been so unfaithful and disloyal at an earlier stage of life. And Paul's saying, no, that's the guy I want here. He's the one that can be useful to me and to encourage me and to uphold me at this time. That's just incredibly instructive.
I have never really put all that together, Sam. That's just fascinating.
Yeah, and here's, you want icing on the cake. This one is the stunning part. Paul obviously received Mark back. Mm-hmm. Peter undoubtedly did. Barnabas did. The church at Colossae did. But then God did, because God used Mark to write one of the four Gospels,
mm-hmm.
which is stunning. You know, people say, well, you know, you engage in a sharp disagreement with an apostle, or today with a pastor or a leader, and man, it's all over for you. You have no hope for the future. And here God not only brought Mark back around, but then entrusted him with the revelation to write the life of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. That blows my mind.
So this miserable failure, who is apparently unreliable, God restored and had him write one of the Gospels.
That's right. And here's the flip side to it all. In that passage in Colossians 4, Paul mentions one other individual who's with him in Rome while he's in prison, a man named Demas.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls him his fellow worker in his letter to Philemon. And yet in 2 Timothy 4, he says, do your best to come to me, because Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and has gone to Thessalonica. So, I mean, the irony here is so thick. Here's Mark, who fails and causes a split with Paul, who at the end of Paul's life is the one person he wants to be present with him.
Wow.
As over against Demas, who seemed to be so diligent and committed to Paul in his first Roman imprisonment, and now he's abandoned him when the going got really rough.
Wow.
And the threat to his life probably was intensified. So, you know, my advice to people when they think about these two individuals is don't make snap judgments. Don't always conclude that because somebody starts out really well, they're going to finish well, because Demas didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And don't always conclude that when somebody slips at the starting line and falls flat on their face that they can't get up and finish the race and win, because Mark did. So
that's tremendous.
So many practical lessons to learn from that.
And Sam, when I think of Paul in prison and Demas, he cares about him. Let me take a little break. When I come back, lots more with Pastor Sam Storms. It is 13 minutes until the top of the hour. I'll be back in a minute. Sam Storms was my guest. He's founder of Enjoying God Ministries, and I'm certainly enjoying Sam as my guest today. I have a question from a listener. Sam, can you define Christian hedonist? Hedonist first, then Christian hedonist.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like fried ice, doesn't it?
A little bit. No. It's a little provocative.
Yeah, it's intended to be provocative. John Piper coined that phrase precisely in order to cause people to stop in their tracks and think about it. Well, we all know what hedonism is. That's a philosophy of life which says that you live and make choices for the greatest amount of pleasure that it can bring you. Christian hedonism is that what motivates us and drives us is the pleasure we find in God and all that He is for us in Jesus. So Christian hedonism recognizes the inescapable reality that God has hardwired us, and this is part of what it means to be created in His image. He's hardwired us for pleasure. We long for joy, delight, fascination, excitement. We want to be enthralled. We want to be captivated. And typically, whatever ends up captivating your heart and bringing you the greatest pleasure is what you're going to give your life to. And Christian hedonism says that the greatest pleasure, the greatest satisfaction of soul is found in knowing God, in enjoying God, in loving God, in serving God. So Christian hedonism, it sounds a little secular when you just focus on the hedonism word.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the reason why it's so important that it be used is because so many Christians think that the Christian life is dreary and boring and monotonous and dull. And boy, the world seems to offer so much more. And what am I missing out on? And, you know, what we argue for in Christian hedonism is what Psalm 16:11 says, in your presence, God, is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. So Christian hedonism is an approach to understanding Scripture and the Christian life that says to people, you want joy? Well, in God's presence, being with Him, knowing Him, loving Him, growing in your intimacy with Him, there's fullness of joy. And the word fullness kind of provokes a vertical image, you know, of a container that's filled up and spills over.
Mm-hmm.
And then He says, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. In other words, pleasures that never lose their capacity to enthrall and captivate us. So Christian hedonism is, again, it's very simply put, as John Piper says, because he coined the term, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him. And, you know, if we were taking a poll of your listeners today and said, what's the most important thing, the primary goal of any believer? And they would all say, well, to glorify God. Nobody would disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you ask the question, how best do you accomplish that? What's the most effective way in which God is glorified? And then you're going to get a whole lot of different answers. And I'm convinced that the answer should be, He's most glorified in me when I am most satisfied and delighted and joyful in Him and all that He is for me and His Son. So that's Christian hedonism in a nutshell. Again, you know, some people don't like the terminology, then I just say don't use it. But I use it precisely because it really opens the door to pressing into the ultimate reason why we exist. And mm-hmm. we exist to glorify God by enjoying Him forever.
Yeah, great answer, Sam. Do we talk about enjoying God very much, or is that something that we have a hard time wrapping our arms around?
Yeah, exactly. Let me give you a quick illustration of that. You mentioned my ministry that I have on the side. It's Enjoying God Ministries. And you have no idea how many times people have written me or asked me questions, and they say, oh, enjoying God's ministries, as if it's the ministries that we're enjoying. I say, no. No, it's God who's the object of our enjoyment. They go, oh. It hits Christians the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be honest, when I first heard that language, I can remember the first time I heard that, and I thought, wait a minute. That I don't think I'd ever put that verb with that noun. You know, worship God, yes. Fear God, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Submit to God.
Of course.
Serve God, okay.
Yep.
Obey God.
Got it.
But enjoying God? It almost sounded flippant. You know, it almost sounded like, well, wait a minute.
Sounds a little trite, doesn't it?
Yeah. How casual. What about suffering and so much that it's a part of being a Christian in this world?
Yeah.
So it took me a while to really get my mind and my heart around the reality that, you know, when Peter says in 1 Peter 1:8, even though you do not see him, you love him. Though you do not see him now, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory. And boy, you know, the psalmist, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, enjoying God is sometimes a bitter pill for some to swallow. They think we're being kind of less than orthodox, less than serious in our approach to the Christian life. But it is a radical, life-changing reality.
Yeah, I mean, because I have, like, the greatest job, because for 2 hours I talk about God with people like you, and I can't have any more fun. I mean, I'm enjoying talking about God. I'm enjoying learning about God. So what does it feel like for you when you're enjoying God?
It is, to use the language of Paul in 2 Corinthians 4, it's seeing the glory of God as revealed in the face of Jesus Christ. It is beholding his attributes, his character, exploring his personality, you know, looking deeply into the nature of God and what he's like and why he makes the decisions that he does, and then resting in the promises that he's made to me. I think that's the principal way in which we find delight in him and joy in him. And then, of course, you know, I think this comes second, is all that he's done for us in Jesus. You know, I want my joy and my delight in him to be primarily for who he is in and of himself. God is intrinsically the most beautiful, the most glorious being in the universe, and that's the firm initial ground for my delight in him. And then as a result of that, I say, wow, I get this God. In other words, he's mine. You know, 1 Peter 3:8, Christ died once for all, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God. So the idea that I get eternity in his presence to be enthralled and fascinated by his beauty and glory, to me, that's the highest expression of what it could mean to enjoy him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there are a lot of fringe benefits that come from that, but I don't want people ever to think that, you know, those are the primary reasons. So I enjoy God because he did this for me. Well,
right.
Yeah, of course we do. But no, I want to enjoy God for who he is in himself. And for me personally, that comes out in the way I worship. And I find such delight in times of singing and celebration and expressing my gratitude. So that's how enjoying God kind of manifests itself concretely in the most immediate way. Now, there are other ways as well, but that's the primary way.
Yeah. Sam, we're out of time, but I would love to get you back on the show to talk about the parable of the prodigal son's father. That would be just a wonderful discussion. So please.
Yeah, you just gave it away, didn't you, by giving the title?
Well, I suppose I did. But by the time you come back on, they will have forgotten. So that's what I hope anyway. Sam, thank you so much for coming on.
To do it.
Okay, terrific.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Sam Storms has been my guest. Go to samstorms.com to learn more about him. We'll take a little break, and we'll be back with more in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.